These Days.
Kids These Days.
This is Kids These Days.
It is the holiday season, and along with the good stuff, there's some other stuff mixed in. Today we're talking about advertising, something we see a lot of during this time of year. Our focus is on how our kids are being marketed to, and how the consumer culture and targeted advertising affect the whole family unit. Plus, we find out about advertising within the walls and halls of some Alaska schools, and can the advertising industry self-regulate? We'll learn about that and a whole lot more this hour on Kids These Days. We don't mean to be curmudgeon-y this holiday season, but when we at Kids These Days were thinking of ideas for what to talk about this time of year, our conversation turned to advertising and the way we see it affecting our own kids. How do parents, teachers, and caregivers deal with the constant presence and pressures of advertising aimed at our children in modern-day living? What do you think? We'd really like to hear from you. Email your thoughts to mail@kidsthesedays.org or comment online there or through Facebook. We'll be having the conversation about advertising with two guests this hour, and for the first half, I'm pleased to welcome Joel Backen. Joel Backen is a professor of law at the University of British Columbia and an internationally renowned legal scholar and commentator. He's the author of the critically acclaimed bestseller, The Corporation, which was made into a film in 2003, and he's most recently published Childhood Under Siege, How Big Business Targets Children. Joel grew up in East Lansing, Michigan, and now resides in Vancouver, Canada, where he lives with his wife, his daughter, and son. He joins us from the CBC studios in Vancouver. And thanks to you, Joel, for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on today.
And I'll mention that later in the hour, Aliza Sherman, an Alaskan author and web pioneer, will join us by phone from Tok to be included in the conversation as well. Well, Joel, it was a fascinating read, I should say, first off, to read your book, Childhood Under Siege. And I'd like to start our conversation by reading to you something that you wrote in chapter one that I found particularly interesting. You say, having discovered that manipulating children's deep emotions is a formula for success, kid marketers push that formula as far as they can, doing whatever it takes without apparent constraint or concern to work the emotions of youth into profit. It's an interesting place, I think, to start this discussion. Tell us about that and then explain how it is that that's happening.
Well, I drew that conclusion on the basis of talking to some kid marketers and asking them what they do. And what I realized is that essentially they see their job as trying to understand what are the unique emotions, what are the unique emotional hot buttons of kids at different ages, because obviously it varies between, say, a 5-year-old and a 15-year-old, and then trying to figure out how to target those, how to manipulate them in order to get kids to want or crave or feel that they need a product. And this isn't something that, you know, is some kind of a hyperbolic criticism of what they're doing. It's kind of a description of what they told me they were doing.
Really? So this is done, obviously, with purpose and intent and design?
Well, it's their job. I mean, that's how they see their job. You know, I talked to the person who is pretty widely viewed as the kind of godfather of kid marketing, a fellow named James McNeil, who really started the whole thing back in the 1960s. And what he told me is that what I saw at the time was that kids are a unique and distinct market from their parents. And what I realized is that now that we had television, we could actually reach them. And so what we had to do is understand how they were different than parents, what was unique about them from a marketer's perspective, and to then try to appeal to what they wanted, not what their parents wanted for them, and to try to work their particular emotions and desires and whatnot to get them to want those things. I then spoke with a fellow who's probably considered to be one of the the leaders, if not the leading kid marketer, a fellow named Martin Lindstrom. And he wrote a book in 2005 or six called Brand Child. And what he does is very scientifically and carefully goes through the different emotions that children uniquely have, and then explains how they can be targeted, how they can be manipulated, so that they fulfill the aims and missions of marketers to get the kids to want things. And you know, it's very sort of scientifically and coldly laid out. And what it got me thinking is that the very thing that we're trying as parents to protect our kids from, namely, we try to guide them in a way that helps them get through the difficult emotions and challenges and searching for identity and not understanding the world. We see all of those things as vulnerabilities that it's our job as parents to try to guide them and protect them. For marketers, those are seen as opportunities to exploit in order to do what their job is, which is to get kids to buy as much stuff or nag their parents to buy as much stuff as possible.
So you talk about the unique wants of children, and you say also that they're different depending on the age group, and that there are, you know, these really intense emotions that kids experience. Can you give some examples of what some of those unique wants are, say, in a particular group of kids, and then how marketers might specifically be playing on those emotions to get the kids to, you know, somehow get those items purchased or bought or used online or whatever it might be?
Well, we can take two examples that Martin Lindstrom talks about. One is he calls the mirror effect, and that is the desire of kids to be older than they are. And he says, you know, this is obviously not something that we adults have. We kind of have the opposite, desiring to be younger. But, you know, kids want to be older, and they think that it's, you know, cooler to be older, and that's what they desire. So then the question is, well, how do you manipulate that? How do you appeal to that? So you can look at things like there was recently I saw a notice about a lingerie line for 5 and 6 year olds. We see the cosmetics industry targeting younger and younger kids. We have this whole issue around the over-sexualization of marketing at ever younger ages. And it's very much a reflection of what Lindstrom is talking about, that kids find real appeal in things that will help them accelerate their aging process, so that a 9-year-old wants to appear or be like a 14-year-old, and a 14-year-old wants to be like an 18-year-old. And a lot of the, I think, ramping up violence in the stuff that boys are being marketed, video games, for example, a lot of the ramping up sexuality and things that girls are being marketed, I think, relate to that. Relate to that idea that we're delivering something that kids want, which is to try to be older, to understand the secrets of the adult world, to be, you know, fascinated with these things that go on that are kind of inappropriate for them and beyond what they should be doing. And there's no question that kids are drawn to that. There is a question about whether it's good for them to, you know, to just push that as far as we can. So that would be one example. Mm-hmm. Another example, and this one hit fairly closely to home in terms of my own teenage daughter, and that is peer obsession. We know that teens are obsessed with the judgment, with the connection, with relationships to their peers. And so that's another sort of unique emotion of adolescence that psychologists have talked about and revealed, and that marketers, again, see as an opportunity. And one of the examples I talk about in the book is a Facebook application called Honesty Box, which really takes that peer obsession idea to the extreme, because what it does is it allows kids within their Facebook friend circle to make anonymous comments about each other. And, you know, you can see where this is going to go when you're dealing with 13, 14, 15-year-olds. They're going to say some very nasty things. They're going to be obviously harmless flirtation kinds of things and whatnot. But But my daughter was subject to some real anonymous harassment. Mm-hmm. Now you say, well, how do you make money out of this? Well, the way that the application makes money out of it is by selling virtual currency that you can buy and then use or try to use to bribe the people who are saying things about you to reveal who they are. And to me, there's nothing really more cynical than this, to take that, you know, that genuine emotion that kids feel and that really causes them a lot of angst during adolescence, you know, how their peers see them, to then create this anonymous way of allowing them to throw these things back and forth, and then to monetize that by, you know, selling this virtual currency, another example. Mm-hmm. And you can also earn the virtual currency by clicking at the sites of third-party advertisers.
Okay.
And then the application gets money from those third-party advertisers for each click-through that they get.
So that's so interesting, and specifically about Honesty Box. I've had some young colleagues of mine who I work with say that one of the things they love about social media is that it's a more or less very positive environment. For example, there's no dislike button on Facebook. But here you're saying that somebody somewhere, some group of people somewhere, came up with a way to anonymously pick on other people if they choose to use it that way and make money off of those emotions. This idea seems like it was architecturally designed, like you say, to prey on kids when they're feeling vulnerable because they've gotten their feelings hurt or you know, they want to be a part of that conversation that's going on Honesty Box. And have you traced specifically Honesty Box where sort of the money is coming from behind that, or where the marketing impetus is coming from to have that be available to kids?
Well, there's a developer. His name is Dan Penguin, and he developed that application and struck a deal with Facebook to put it on Facebook. And you know, he makes money from the virtual currency. He also makes money from the third-party advertiser click-throughs, and then some of that revenue goes to Facebook, which hosts the application. And I think, you know, it's fair to say that Facebook itself is a positive environment in the way that you describe. That doesn't mean that all the applications on Facebook will be, which raises the whole question of how Facebook and other social media police the various applications that end up on it. And it also raises a larger question, I think, of, you know, if we have a world in which the primary concern of marketers is to make money off of youth, and if exploiting youth emotions is a way of getting at that, then it's hard to be confident that in the longer run, you know, Facebook will necessarily maintain its sense of being a warm environment. But let me sort of flip that idea and mention that one of the things that, again, this kid marketing guru Martin Lindstrom says is, you know, those are only two emotions, the ones we just talked about. Another emotion he talks about is the desire for connection among kids. And I think that is something that the fairly friendly environment of Facebook plays upon. Obviously, it's not playing upon emotions associated with violence or with sexuality or with any of those things, but it is playing on this intense desire of kids to connect up with other kids and adults to some extent. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the way teens use it, I mean, it's really become a kind of platform for the entirety of their social lives. And that, too, has some problems, as I talk about it at length in the book, despite the fact that, yes, it is a friendly environment.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is Kids These Days. I'm Shanna Sheehy. I'm speaking with Joel Back in this hour about how advertising and kid marketing affects our children and the whole family unit. And I think it's time for this. It often seems like we and our kids are bombarded by advertisements. Think of those brightly colored flyers picturing toys, toys, and more toys that make up the bulk of the Sunday paper this time of year, not to mention ads on TV and the internet. Sometimes it seems like a free-for-all. Are there any rules governing all this marketing? marketing. Kids These Days contributor Jessica Cochran discovered the world of advertising self-regulation.
The Children's Advertising Review Unit is housed at the Council of Better Business Bureaus. It's funded by a coalition of advertising organizations, and its mission is to make sure national advertisements directed at children age 12 and under are accurate, truthful, and fair. Director Wayne Keeley says its set of guidelines have been developed over years of experience. The organization was founded in the 1970s.
Advertising law has been developing over the years, and some of the guidelines are based on general advertising laws, and others are based on best practices and what we've seen in the industry and what the industry and academic advisors have developed.
The group reviews about 5,000 pieces of advertising a year, television commercials, print media in children's magazines, websites. If they determine an advertisement violates one of their guidelines, they approach the advertiser and ask them to pull or alter it.
Most of the time, I would say 95, if not more, percent of the time, the advertisers and website operators work with us and come to a resolution of our concerns and the issues and go forward without further action. In very rare cases, very rare, seldom does it happen, an advertiser may say they disagree and they will just ignore our recommendations. In that case, we refer the case to the appropriate law enforcement agency, which in most cases, because it's advertising, is the Federal Trade Commission or the FTC.
That happened recently when a website, streetsurfing.com, disagreed that videos on their site showed kids using inadequate safety gear. Some of the guidelines are pretty clear-cut. No product labeled "keep out of reach of children" can be marketed directly to kids, even if it's a children's vitamin. Others may be a little more subjective. Advertisements shall not mislead children about the benefits of using the product, such as that a certain product will make them smarter or more popular. In light of the childhood obesity epidemic, the guidelines include some language about how food is advertised to kids. It should be shown in proper serving sizes, and if a meal is portrayed, it should be a balanced meal. A separate self-regulating effort, the Children's Food and Beverage Advertising Initiative, looks at what food is advertised to kids. It's laid out new uniform nutrition standards for 10 categories of foods. Foods that don't meet them will no longer be allowed to be marketed to kids. By CFBAI's estimates, one-third of the foods now marketed to kids won't be eligible when the new guidelines kick in. Margot Wutan is Director of Nutrition Policy for Center for Science and the Public Interest, and she agrees with that estimate.
But what it means in terms of the marketplace is much more modest. It means, like, out of all the popsicles that are currently marketed to kids, a couple of them won't be able to be marketed. Out of the yogurts, a couple will fall out. Out of the sugary cereals, a couple won't meet. But still, the overall mix of products that'll be advertised and marketed to kids will be the same old junk: sugary cereals, fast food, sugary drinks, snack foods, white flour pasta smothered in salty sauce. Not very healthy.
Wutan says the self-regulation programs are certainly better than nothing, but the progress is too slow.
Over the last 5 years that companies have been agreeing to self-regulate their food advertising to kids, the amount of junk food advertising has gone down from about 90% of the food ads on television being for unhealthy foods to just 80%. So 90% to 80%, that's some progress, which is good to see, but it's certainly not enough to address junk food marketing and childhood obesity.
Wutan would like to see the industry adopt tougher nutrition standards in self-regulating what amounts to a pretty big advertising effort. According to an FTC report, the food industry spends $1.7 billion a year marketing unhealthy foods to kids. It's left to people like Carol Fink to counter all those messages with healthier ones. She's director of the State of Alaska Obesity Prevention and Control Program. The state has a new media campaign beginning in January. Television and radio ads, Facebook and print, all encouraging families to be more active, to get out and play. The budget for that campaign? $500,000. I'm Jessica Cochran.
And I'm Shanna Sheehy. This is Kids These Days, and today we're talking with Joel Bakken about advertising and marketing to young people. Joel, I was wondering what your experience is with self-regulation in the advertising industry.
Well, I tend to agree with Margaret Wooten that in some ways it's better than nothing, but its overall impact has been fairly minimal. Studies that have been done of the food initiative, for example, the CFBI, by independent agencies, not by it itself, have suggested that its impact has been very minimal. And, you know, it takes me to the idea that an economist named Willem Buiter, he's an economist at Citibank, and he mentioned this in the context of banking, but I think it applies here as well. He said that self-regulation is kind of like other self things, like self-righteousness. It bears as close a connection to regulation as self-righteousness bears to righteousness, or self-importance bears to importance. And I think that's the real issue. Why are we content with self-regulation if we're dealing with what, in the case of obesity, for example, is a public health crisis? Why are we content with simply saying, okay, well, we'll use self-regulation or we'll use education? Why are we so timorous about regulating? Mm-hmm. And I think that is the big elephant in the room around these issues. And I was heartened to see Michelle Obama's commission on obesity, the report that it produced, basically said self-regulation is fine if it's working, if it's enforced, if its standards are good standards. But if we find it isn't working, then Congress needs to step in. And I think that's been the position of a lot of people in this debate. It's been that we can't simply hand this issue over to industry and say, okay, go regulate yourself, and then not think about it anymore. What we need to do is have some kind of a co-regulation mechanism between governments and industry, where industry and governments decide on appropriate standards, decide on enforcement mechanisms, and where industry goes off and self-regulates, but government continues to review what it's doing and to ensure that it's doing a good job and that it's working. And if it isn't working, then industry, then government has to step in with regulation. Unfortunately, we seem to have reached this place where we say we can't regulate. The best we can hope for is self-regulation and maybe some government-sponsored education campaigns.
Well, it's interesting. I found this when I was reading specifically about evidence that there might be that advertisements, you know, do exposure to junk food in media may have an effect on children. So I'd like to share this. This is an article that was published in the New York Times in July 2009, and it's by Alex Midland. And I'm quoting here. He says, in one experiment conducted by researchers from the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale, 118 children, ages 7 to 11, were given bowls of Goldfish crackers and then left to watch a 14-minute cartoon. During the commercial breaks, some of the children saw ads for games and entertainment. Others watched four spots for unhealthy snacks like waffle sticks with syrup, fruit roll-ups, and potato chips. And the children who saw the food spots ate 45% more Goldfish than those who watched the game commercials. And according to the authors, the experiment suggests a direct link between food advertising and greater snack consumption. I feel like that could be an argument for why more regulation, especially in light of things like an obesity epidemic, are important at this time.
There's a ton of evidence like that. And, you know, the other way of looking at it, it's like the argument about tobacco. I mean, the tobacco industry insisted our advertising efforts don't increase the number of people who smoke. All they do is affect brand preference among people who are already smokers or already will smoke. And then you ask the question, then why are you spending billions of dollars every year? And I think it's the same thing with junk food advertising. The marketers certainly know that their efforts work. The advertisers know that their efforts work, and the companies that hire the ad agencies and the marketers know that it's worth spending money on that. It would be highly irresponsible for companies to spend shareholders' money on hiring advertising and marketing firms if their efforts had no effect. So, you know, just from that, it's reasonable to deduce that these efforts do, in fact, increase kids' desire for these foods. When you add to that the kind of work that's been done in universities and nutrition departments and whatnot, and it all shows the same as what you mentioned, the example you mentioned, it all shows that these ads do, in fact, increase kids' appetites for the foods that are being advertised. And there's another element of this that relates back to self-regulation. And that is that the self-regulation regimes that exist tend not to have anything to say about the amount of advertising that's directed at children. They tend to be related to the content of advertising. And one of the really important things to remember in this whole debate is that 40 years ago, all we had was a television set in the living room. That was kids' exposure to advertising. Now, most kids, or many kids, have TVs in their bedrooms. They have gaming consoles where they're seeing ads. They have computers. They have smartphones. They have tablets. The Kaiser Family Foundation recently found that the average engagement of an average kid, a tween or a teen, with media each day is close to 8 hours. That is fundamentally different than anything that was going on 20, 30 years ago. You then add to that the fact that the media they're engaging with is no longer just the sort of one-dimensional television set, but it's interactive, it's social, it's games, it's incredibly compelling, that the advertising is no longer just an interruption in content, but it's written right into the programs. I mean, you know, if you watch American Idol, you'll see they're drinking Coke from Coke cups. The judges are. The kids involved in it are doing these fun videos around Ford cars. So advertising is no longer separate from content. It's part of content. And marketing is no longer simply marketers aiming at children, but now we have all these viral techniques. And advertising has been made part of the fun rather than an interruption of the fun. So participatory marketing, word-of-mouth marketing, viral marketing, it's all very interactive and becoming increasingly social. So the challenge is not simply about looking at the content of ads, but it's looking at the breadth of exposure that kids are getting, not only from media, but in schools and just about everywhere. And that's not being addressed by any of these self-regulatory regimes.
Well, Kids These Days is an independent production of the Content Producers Guild. We're distributed through the Alaska Public Radio Network, and we record this program at the studios of KSKA-FM in Anchorage. We thank both APRN and KSKA for their support and partnership. Thanks also to you, our listeners in Anchorage, the Mat-Su, Juneau, Dillingham, Unalaska, and Prudhoe Bay. I'll be back after a quick break to talk more with Joel Bakken. Alaskan Aliza Sherman will be joining that conversation as we return as well. Also still to come, the scoop on advertising in some Alaska schools. Stay with us.
Stop.
Many of us tell our kids, Christmas isn't about what we get, it's about what we give. Sound familiar? Well, Kids These Days is celebrating this holiday season with a program that's all about giving. We'll tell you about kids' books that help young ones understand the power of generosity. And we'll introduce you to a Matsu pair who put their craftiness to work for the good of others. Join us for that and more next time. We're back. You're listening to Kids These Days. On this program, we talk weekly about issues that matter to youth and families and our communities as a whole. In this hour, during the holiday season, we're exploring the world of advertising and kid marketing and what we as caregivers need to understand about how it's done. How do you help your kids understand the messages they're getting from so many media sources? Tell us by going to our Facebook page, commenting on our website, or sending an email to mail@kidsthesedays.org. Joel Backen, author of Childhood Under Siege, is with us still, and we're welcoming Aliza Sherman for the rest of the conversation. Aliza Sherman is a web pioneer, the author of 9 books. She's a keynote speaker and has been a digital strategist since 1992. She speaks around the world and writes about the internet, social media, mobile marketing, and new technologies. Her latest books are The Complete Idiot's Guide to Crowdsourcing and Mom Incorporated. She's married to a wildlife biologist and is the mother of a 5-year-old daughter. She joins us by phone from Toke today. Thanks, Aliza, for being with us today.
Thank you so much for including me.
Well, I know you've been listening to the conversation so far, Aliza, and Joel Backen was just talking about the breadth of exposure and really explaining that in such a clear and concise way, how children are just exposed to so much more marketing and advertising today. I'm wondering, with your background and experience, what's your perception of that from where you're coming from?
Well, coming from an internet marketer's standpoint, I can say yes, indeed, that is happening. That's not just happening in traditional media, in radio, in television, in print, but it is also happening online, and the motivations behind this kind of marketing and marketing directed at children, it's the same across the board, regardless of where what medium you're using to get that message across. And from a parent standpoint, this is so scary. I listened for the first part of the show thinking, this is really producing a lot of work that I'm going to have to pay close attention to. It increases our responsibility as parents to educate our children, to hopefully combat some of these messages that aren't positive.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that brings me back to a question I had in the first half of the hour, too, where, Joel, you were giving a specific example about how some lingerie and sexy underwear lines are being marketed to children who are 5 and 6 and very, very young girls. It made me wonder, you know, who is the parent who goes to the store and sees lingerie for his 5-year-old or her 5-year-old and buys that? How is that happening?
Yeah, well, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, as a parent, I would not do that at all. I find it frightening. And also as a parent, I was getting my daughter paper doll applications off of the iPhone, iPad from iTunes, and she was playing these games. And even in the games, the images that are targeting these young girls have lingerie and bras. And that, to me, it starts so incredibly young that my 4-year-old was asking for a bra when she was 4. So that, to me, shows that there's this pervasive underlying messaging that's happening. Even that was not an advertisement. It was within the game itself, just as you were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm. Joel Backen?
Well, I think, you know, that is the $64,000 question. What is the responsibility of parents in relation to all of this? And what is the responsibility of society more broadly? And one of the frustrations I have, and part of the reason I wrote this book, is that I feel the debate has only really deals with one aspect of that. It's always seen as a matter of parenting and not seen as a matter of broader responsibility. And I think the obesity epidemic is a really good example of that. There's no question that parents can do better and worse jobs in terms of navigating through the immense amount of marketing that is trying to get their kids to have appetites for unhealthy food. So you can say no, you can provide healthy alternatives, but it's hard enough to get your kids to eat well without all this marketing. What you have control over is, to some extent, you have control when they're young enough and they're not out in the world making their own decisions, as of around 9 or 10, you know, walking down the local fast food outlet. You have some control over what you can feed them, but what you have less control over, and it picks up on the point that was made about the desire of a four-year-old girl for a bra, what you have less control over is their desires, what they see as desirable, how they see the world, how they see themselves, how they see what healthy eating is or what a healthy approach to their body is. All of that is very much being dictated by their engagement with media, both at school and at home and when they're out on the road with their smartphones. So the issue about parental responsibility is a very complicated one. We don't parent in a vacuum. And, you know, you can think of the example, if you want to teach your child that that knives aren't a good thing and that they might harm them, you can put your child on the floor and throw a bunch of knives on the floor and say, okay, you know, see what you can do, and you should learn not to use them. Or you cannot put the knives on the floor. You know, you can say, we're not going to put that threat there in the first place. And I think what we as a society have to think about is trying to make parents' jobs easier in terms of inculcating good values, healthy attitudes, and healthy habits. Right now, we're making that job very, very difficult by creating an environment that's creating wants and desires and felt needs in children that aren't healthy, and then putting us as parents in a defensive position.
Mm-hmm. Aliza?
I was also thinking from a parent standpoint, many of the parents today were brought up with all of this kind of advertising and marketing. Many parents are equally as affected. And so it's almost a losing battle in a sense, because many of us are convinced that this marketing was okay back then and aren't fully aware and educated about what's happening today. But the other piece of it, too, is we need to be working cooperatively with other parents, with the school systems, with any of the local and environmental messaging that's happening. It does take responsibility not just of the parents, but of citizens in a community. Having moved from a very large city, I was living in New York City for many years without a child, and then moving to Anchorage, Alaska, and then moving to Tok, we are not exposed to a lot of media here. And in a sense, I am parenting in a bit of a vacuum, if you will. We do not get television, and there are no movie theaters. There are no commercials for her to see unless she's at a babysitter's home or a friend's home. So it's up to me to now work cooperatively with other parents to say, you know, my daughter doesn't watch those shows. She doesn't watch commercials, and we really prefer that way. So could you find an alternative way of play? And when we travel and turn on a television, you can see how it penetrates their brains. Because at first, my daughter hated commercials. She thought they were interruptions to her enjoyable show. Now, she asks for the products that she sees. That's just within a year and a half span of time. So I have to talk to my mother and say, when we're visiting, please keep the television off. Let's select what we'd like our daughter or your granddaughter to watch.
Mm-hmm. Well, Aliza Sherman, that's very interesting what you say about how some, you know, in many cases, parents these days have grown up in this kind of environment, although it's changed with new media technology. Joel Bakken, I'd love it if you could explain a little bit about how we got here. In your book, Childhood Under Siege, you talk about the century of the child, which was our last century, and then you talk about a period of time when things start to change, and I'd love it if you could repeat some of that information for us today.
Sure. If you go back to the late 19th century, you start to see ideas that had been kicking around sort of since the European Enlightenment manifesting themselves in public policy. You start to see people becoming concerned about the fact that children are working in mines, for example, and you see movements against child labor. And an idea develops, as I say, it really goes back to the 18th century and some of the philosophers of that time who said that children are different. Children are special. Children are developing beings, and they have to be seen in that way, and society has to invest in them in that way. And so you start to see in the late 19th century movements to get kids out of the labor force, to get kids into public schools, and you see the rise of a public school system. I mean, this was a huge public project in terms of saying that we want to cultivate educations in kids so that they can have choices in their lives. We want to cultivate ideas about citizenship so we can have a functioning democracy. We want to cultivate certain competencies so that when they become older, they can be productive in the workforce. So all of these ideas were very idealistic, but eventually became things that we now take for granted. The notion that kids should be educated, the notion that kids shouldn't be exploited as workers. And what I try to do in the book is I trace that history of a roughly 100-year period. I titled the chapter Century of the Child because that was the title of a book that prophesized this would happen, that was published in 1900. And my argument is that the Century of the Child kind of ended in 1980. When and around that time, when we saw a real political shift in terms of the appropriate role for government. Because what had been happening over the previous 100 years was a view that government is actually a relevant force in trying to create to protect various public interests, including the health and well-being and development of children. In the 1980s, we start to get a different view. We get the view that deregulation is really what we should be striving for, privatization, that government doesn't have a role to play in these things. And we see this view still in play today, especially, on the Republican side of the ledger, and the Tea Party movement probably takes it to its most extreme place. And so the notion then that there is a public responsibility of us as citizens through our democratic institutions to regulate the economy in ways that will be conducive to the health and well-being of children. That is not a very popular notion in public policy circles these days. And I guess, what I suggest is we should really revisit that idea because I think it's a pretty good idea.
Well, this is Kids These Days. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and today Joel Bakken and Aliza Sherman join me for a conversation about marketing to children in a modern North America. As education budgets continue to get slashed while the costs of schooling children continue to rise, some public schools in the United States are taking a closer look at advertising dollars to make ends meet. One school district in Texas is selling space to advertisers on the inside of school buses, while another district in Colorado will rake in $90,000 over 3 years for selling ad space on report cards. We're hearing more of these stories every day from around the country. So we wanted to know, how do Alaskans feel about advertising in our schools? Alaska Teen Media Institute reporter Aviva Hirsch has this answer.
For decades, Alaska schools have asked companies to sponsor publications such as yearbooks and playbills, or sports teams in exchange for promotion. And with the current heightened economic situation, some schools are even more crunched for funding. To generate extra revenue, many school districts across the country have invited advertisers into the classrooms and other school properties. Carol Como is the superintendent of the Anchorage School District.
I do know, I've read really bizarre things, like in some school district, either in Oklahoma or Texas, they painted a business logo on the roof of the school. And then as people flew over, they could see. I mean, that's how far some school districts have gone. So I think people are all pretty desperate for revenue.
The United Independent School District in Laredo, Texas, began selling ad space on the outside of school buses in the 2011 school year, which by early November had earned $20,000 for the district, and they had only sold ad space on 35 of their 400 buses. Some states, including Florida, even allow ads inside the buses. Advertising in schools and on school property garners income for districts, but leads to debate surrounding the direct effect on students. West Anchorage High School teacher David Vano shares his opinion.
I don't know the impact of advertising in such a sacred place. And so my first reaction, my first response is to reject the whole idea. We already live in a society that encourages, overemphasizes consumption.
Tam Agosti-Giesler, the executive director of Anchorage School Business Partnerships, has a different view on the matter.
I think young people are pretty savvy as it is, and they're bombarded on a daily basis by so much advertising already. I think they've learned to either tune it out or to let it in as their interests allow.
Agosti-Giesler argues that students must be slowly introduced to the world of adulthood, where one is responsible for making choices. As it is, the school district has partners that do not specifically adhere to healthy food guidelines, like pizza and vending machine companies, laying the responsibility in the hands of students.
I do notice them sometimes, and I don't eat the kind of food that's in the vending machines, and I don't like to support those industries, but it doesn't really affect how I learn at school or anything like that.
Says West High student Katie Dalton. Maddie Moore, another West High student, thinks people may not even be aware of the effects advertising has on them.
Just walking by something every day, you don't even realize it, but you're, you know, subconsciously taking in the advertisement. I think it's a sneaky way to get people to think about their products.
Agosti-Giesler gives us an example of advertising at work.
I remember hearing a story of a student, this has more to do with a university there where he got a ruler, had the University of Washington's name on it when he was in third grade. And he used that ruler all through high school, and it definitely had an impact on him when he was applying to universities. He was looking at his ruler one day going, well, I'm going to apply to University of Washington. And he did, and he ended up being a student there. I'm not saying that there is not an impact in having someone's name out there, you know, that is part of our capitalist society, and I don't have a problem with advertising.
Agosti-Giesler has helped the Anchorage School District develop partnerships with businesses ranging from nonprofits to large corporations to state agencies and even faith-based organizations. West Anchorage High School allows Credit Union One to house a branch within its school building. Chrissy Bell is the Community Engagement Director of Credit Union One.
While we're there really to provide the financial education, it also, you know, it is a two-way partner, you know, it's a school business partnership. And so, you know, West helps us to sort of get our name out there a little bit more and you know, help promote.
Credit Union One's not blanketing our school and not forcing kids to take, you know, get accounts at Credit Union One. It's completely optional. So there's a good give and take relationship there.
That was the principal at West Anchorage High School, Rick Stone.
It's okay to look at, be creative to come up with funding for the school, so it's not always on the taxpayers to support the schools as much as, you know, we need the support. But again, there needs to be, I don't want to sell my soul to advertisement. There has to be a direct benefit for our kids, not just to see advertisements.
Carol Como, the superintendent of the Anchorage School District.
I think the key is that we don't allow any advertising function or activity which has the motive of profit to a private individual, firm, or corporation unless specifically approved by myself or the principal.
While money is tight and schools may be increasingly inclined to pursue relationships with advertisers and businesses, Principal Rick Stone hopes that his school district will never succumb to the amount of advertising seen in some districts around the country.
We got to protect our kids. We can't have them walking through our schools and just being bombarded by advertisements all day long.
The common thought is that whatever happens, advertising and the presence of businesses in schools should not get in the way of learning. For kids these days, this is Aviva Hirsch.
Aviva Hirsch is a senior at West Anchorage High School and has helped with her reporting from mentors at the Alaska Teen Media Institute. Listen to more stories by Aviva and other ATME students on their website. We'll link you to it from ours at kidsthesedays.org. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and I'm speaking with Joel Backen and Aliza Sherman this hour. Aliza, you're joining us by phone from Tok, and I'm wondering, will there be buses driving around Tok with Fast Eddie's banners on them soon? Is that happening out where you are and in a more rural part of our state?
Well, I do know that money is a major issue, particularly with rural schools, and here in Tok, it's no different. I think that the local businesses have been very supportive of different school activities, and in a sense, it seems to be a bit of an exchange there, where if Fast Eddie's, as you say, or Three Bears happens to provide something, there is that expectation or the offer of a return logo on a program, for example. There certainly is some signage at events and at the school that is marketing-type materials. I see less from national or even statewide companies and more that local recognition, as it said in the story, for providing some resources that they otherwise would not have had. It begins to get frightening if you think of the major corporations coming in, the companies that offer unhealthy foods, that offer questionable clothing, and other kinds of products. That's when I think our radars may go up. Mm-hmm. So it's a fine line, though, I think.
Yeah, for sure. Joel Bakken, in your book, Childhood Under Siege, there's a section in there where you talk about the marketization, if that is such a word, of education. And you describe how standardized testing has become sort of its own industry that has its own interest in within education. I'm wondering if you could tell us about that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there are different elements of ways that schools serve, in effect, as cash cows for various companies. And one of them, as we've just been talking about, is using schools as platforms for marketing. But another is developing and providing core education services. And back in the mid-2000s, when I was conducting interviews for the Corporation Project, one of the fellows I talked to was Benno Schmidt Jr., who's the former president of Yale University and is now involved in what's called the education industry. And what he told me is that behind healthcare, education is the largest potential source of revenue in the country, in the United States, that it's bigger than the auto industry or military industry or any of those industries. And corporations have had their sights on that for a long time. And they are, an industry has been developing very quickly over the last 10, 20 years of corporations running schools. We have what are called education management organizations, EMOs, which are similar to HMOs, that in many cities, increasing numbers, are actually running schools. They're for-profit corporations. Managing schools, running schools, providing curricula for schools, providing standardized tests for schools, marking those tests. So in all these different ways, we've seen, if we look at, as I say, especially the last 10, 20 years, an increasing presence of big companies providing core education services. And teachers kind of fading more into the background in terms of their control of what is being taught, and school administrators as well. So I talk about this in the book as I think even a larger issue than the issue of whether ads are being placed on the sides of school buses, albeit that's a very important issue too.
And one that's very visible. Hmm. Well, in the time that we have left, I feel like it's important to give caregivers an idea of what they can do. What are some practical things that they can do to help in this new landscape that we are all parenting and raising children in? I'd like to mention that we, from kidsthesedays.org, will link to some really fantastic resources about media literacy and other places that you as a parent can find out how you can best talk and have conversations with your kids about advertising, such as PBSKids.org has a great Don't Buy It part of their site. There's Adbusters. In Canada, there's a website that's called Media Awareness that's really fantastic. I found some great stuff there. About Face is an organization that helps young girls see how they're told about body image and so forth in advertisements and marketing. So from kidsthesedays.org, we will link to those. But I'd like to ask each of you to maybe give some thoughts for how we can do our best to help our kids through this.
Well, I'll just jump in. I think all of those resources are fantastic resources. I think that, education is a primary part of this. But I also think we have to think about how we can work in our communities, as Elisa pointed out, to work as citizens in trying to deal with this at a broader level than simply as individual parents, including bringing in local, state, and even federal governments, and looking at the kinds of possibilities for curbing some of especially the more toxic and I think harmful aspects of the marketing world that our kids are being exposed to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I have two things. The education obviously is an important one, and cooperation and participation. But my two things are, be a good role model. If there are things that you don't want your child to be doing, look at your own behavior. I myself don't like eating a lot of sugared foods. I have a 5-year-old daughter now who will not take a lot of candy at a party or only have a little tiny bit of cake and ice cream because she knows her mom thinks that sugar is bad and she feels sugar is bad. So they mirror us. And the second thing is, don't feel helpless. Do something. You can take action, whether it's in your community, in your household, at large, in some way. Do something to make a difference. One of the things I did was with these apps that show the lingerie for little girls and paper dolls, my daughter and I created our own app, Girls Can Be Anything Paper Dolls, age-appropriate clothing, no lingerie. Now, I'm not saying everyone can go out and produce an app, but you could write an article or you could tell stories at school. You can do something to perpetuate positive messages out there in your community.
Well, that's all the time we have today. It's really been a fascinating conversation. Thank you, both of you. Aliza is an Alaskan and web pioneer. She's a speaker and author who joined the conversation today from her home in Tok. Thanks so much, Aliza.
Thank you.
And Joel Bakken. Joel is a professor of law at the University of British Columbia and the author of Childhood Under Siege, How Big Business Targets Children. He joined us today from the CBC in Vancouver. Thanks, Joel, for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll link you to both Joel's and Aliza's work, as well as media literacy resources I mentioned, all from kidsthesedays.org. You can also listen to this entire program again from our website and share it with your friends so they can hear it too. That's it for Kids These Days today. Aviva Hirsch reported from Anchorage for this show. Special thanks to Rosie Robards and Robert Stormo with the Alaska Teen Media Institute for their production assistance with Aviva's story. And a special congratulations to Aviva. She graduates from high school before the year's end. Way to go, Aviva. Hannah O'Brien is our 49 Writers Write Young Alaska and Kids These Days essay contest winner. Jessica Cochran is a regular contributor, technical editor, and assistant producer. Sarah Gonzalez produces this program, regularly reports for us, maintains and coordinates all of our electronic media, and manages the business side of things. Lost Lander composes and performs our original music. I'm Shanna Sheehy, your host. Thanks so much for spending time with me today. I'll see you next time.
Kids These Days is an independent production of the Content Producers Guild. The opinions shared on the program are those of the host, guest, and contributors and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of KTD producers, partners, or funders. Major funding for Kids These Days comes from the Association of Alaska School Boards and its Initiative for Community Engagement. The program is made in partnership with KSKA-FM in Anchorage and the Alaska Public Radio Network. Find out more about Kids These Days anytime at kidsthesedays.org.